a decent guard might be able to eliminate a lot of the mistakes. They spent 15 years of substantial theoretical and development work trying to build a trusted system, and they've not really succeeded yet. And current predictions are that another 20 years of work is needed to address the currently known problems with these systems. Automated protection checkers and setters are actually getting to be fairly common. There are a lot of Unix-based tools. There's NID and similar multi-platform tools, network security management tools, and like that. If you could actually figure out what the right settings were ahead of time, it's fairly easy to automate setting them. The hard problem is figuring out what all the right bit settings are, because any single mistake potentially opens up a hole that can be exploited to take over the whole thing. Trusted application programs. You can, for example, a secure web or Gopher server designed to provide secure versions of commonly used services. You know, the Netscape is 80,000 lines of code in their original implementation or something. So 80,000 lines of code is not secure. I can tell you that, not having ever seen one bit of that code, because nobody's ever written an 80,000 line program that is really and truly secure against everything we've brought up. You can write an 80 line program that is relatively secure. You can demonstrate it mathematically and only find a few bugs along the way. Trusted mail guards to permit things that would otherwise be a violation of double pagel policy, for example. And most device drivers that are written for secure operating systems are considered to be trusted applications. Trustworthy or not is another issue, but they are trusted. You can use isolated sub-file system areas. For example, Unix has the chroot environment to let you put somebody into a subsection of the file system for the purposes of a particular function. And if it's implemented well, then it'll be very difficult for them to break out of that. There is the mandatory access controls in various configurations. And then VMs. You remember VM? Anybody remember the VM operating? Does that still exist, Ian? Go out there? VMs, virtual disks and these things. That's essentially the same thing, unless you create an isolated portion of the system. I'm glad to see there's a lot of support for VM. I thought VM was really one of the cleverest operating system innovations in a long time. And seems like it died on the vine, but apparently it lives on. The use of quotas, and there are lots of different ways to use quotas. For users, groups of users, function, program, any other consumer of resources can be limited by quotas. For example, disk quotas are available in many operating systems. CPU cycle quotas are imposed in some environments on a usage per time basis, so that you can't use more than 5% of the total resources of the system, which makes it a lot harder to deny services. And then file handle quotas. In time sharing systems, it's fairly common to limit the number of file handles per process. Unfortunately, it's usually set so it's three or four processes is enough to take over the whole system. But if you set these things wisely, you can eliminate a lot of denial of services problems. Memory usage quotas imposed by time sharing systems. One of the problems with quotas is the idea of having all this capability here is that people can use it. And by putting up quotas, you're sort of limiting what people can effectively do. And there's some level at which you impose the quotas to where they say, I can't get my job done anymore. Properly prioritized resource usage would be nice. For example, remember when I was talking earlier about these problems of network interrupts being having a higher priority than disk interrupts? So, for example, it can't page something out because the network it can't page in the network handling program because there's a network interrupt. So if you thought about it, you could probably prioritize these things a little bit more carefully, but people don't. And the fact is, there isn't that much time available to do systems administration and very little systems administration expertise overall in the world, which is one of the reasons that we're sort of unable to really do these things well. Sort of an interesting idea is detection before failure. And a real good example of this is at CMU, there were some experiments in the 70s and 80s where they looked at behavioral patterns in networks, and before a failure occurred, they could predict in sometimes as much as 48 hours ahead of time that there was going to be a failure and schedule a reboot of the machine that was going to fail ahead of time. So there are, if you look carefully at the behavioral statistics of machines, you can often predict failures long ahead of time and do something about them. You get multi-version systems. where you know, end version programming, so to speak, where one version fails, but before the whole set of them fail, you're able to repair the system. You can have coding-based fault detection, where you detect a fault before it becomes a failure by using encoding of information. And of course, you can test for faults. So sometimes you have systems that you have test programs running in all the time, and they detect something going wrong long before a user actually sees the impact. That's another. What we see very often is human intervention after detection. So, you know, oh, something went wrong. People rush in and try and fix it. This is maybe the last reserve of defenders of systems. In fact, most methods for disaster recovery fit into this category. Updating of known virus checkers, for example, for each new virus that comes along is, you know, they don't generally come up with the next pattern until somebody detected the virus. So somebody got hit, and then they update everybody else. So as a community, that's a very effective thing, but for the individual that got hit, takes life tough. Recovering from most denial of services attacks involves people coming in, figuring it out. Now, if you're in a satellite situation, you probably can't send those people up there very often. Okay, maybe it's worth it for big lenses, but most satellites, you better be able to fix it without human intervention. And like that. Physical security, gates, guards, guns is what they often talk to about. Fences and other barriers. Physics-based alarm systems. Physical security is expensive, and it's never perfect. But without it, any other kind of security you use is doomed to failure. So you need to have some level of, and ultimately, because if I can go in and modify the hardware that you're running on and modify the software that you're using by physically accessing it, not much you can do about it. Now, redundancy, I can't say much about redundancy that isn't sort of obvious, because it's a really redundant sort of thing to speak in great length about redundancy, if you know what I mean. Backup, standby, simple redundancy code. It costs. More redundancy costs more. If you want privacy, guess what? Redundancy needs more copies of the thing you're trying to keep private. That means you've got to work harder to keep all of them private instead of some of them private. Or corporal, I don't know. Sorry, really very subtle piece of humor there. You want to look at that on a case-by-case basis. Case-by-case-by-case-by-case basis. You have uninterruptible power supplies and motor generators. A lot of things fall into the category of redundancy. I sort of put that in as a catch-all, so you couldn't say, you know, oh, you missed this one. Nope, it's redundancy. Oh, is that for us? Oh, thank you. We have here your bibliography sheets. Yeah, so if you just pass them out. And we have here the copies of your reference sheet. I hate to be redundant in a question. The power supply, well, first of all, power is the lifeblood of information systems, as we all know. So without power, eventually everything falls over and stays falling over in information technology. So uninterruptible power provides continuous condition power during brownouts and blackouts and across a lot of electrical conditions, but typically it runs on batteries, and batteries don't last that long. It's very expensive, very heavy, et cetera. So you need to have something next level backup, and the next level backup is typically motor generators for sort of long-term slow response time, typically, you know, maybe as much as short as a half a second or something, but rarely before the next cycle of 60 cycles gets there for motor generators. And please don't forget to refill it with gas and check the gas levels periodically, because as we all know, when your motor generator is out of gas, it doesn't particularly matter that you had it. And then you get power conditioning switches and supplies and other devices, et cetera, that catch spikes, lightning, and similar events. It's the standard off-the-shelf stuff. You know, you can get it at the hardware store, over the internet. There's I favor particular brands because they've worked for me for a long time, but there are lots of fine vendors and probably some here. Encryption is the last bastion of those that think that they can. Well, there are two types of people that rush to encryption. One is the people that think you can solve anything by encryption. These are the hammer people, or the square pegs. They say, I've got a hammer, now whatever it is, I can hit it. You know, it's a screw, no problem. I can hammer it in. It'll work. So there's that whole class of people that believe that. And then there's another class of people who I'll call the crypto crazies out there. The crypto crazies are the people that want to encrypt everything to a level where nobody will ever be able to read them. And the problem, of course, in any organizational situation is that actually the information has value and in encrypted form it doesn't. So normally organizations want a way to be able to decrypt the information that their employees have generously encrypted for them. Otherwise, when the employee gets hit by a truck, they will not have the plans for the next century of whatever, or the new design of the automobile. So there's this trade-off, and it's actually, if you think about it, this is closely related to safes. Okay? You may not be aware of this, but almost any safe, the whole technology of safes is not designed to prevent people from ever getting in. That is not the way a safe is designed. If you want to design a system that will keep somebody from ever getting in, you can do that. But that's not what safes do. What safes do is they make it so it takes a particular amount of time to get in. Okay, so that when you talk about how to break into a safe, the guy that comes in when you forget the combination, he just uses the standard technique for breaking into the safe. You know, drill a hole here, drill a hole there, do this, do that, whatever you do to open that safe. The point is it takes him, you know, 18 hours to open that bank vault. And that's the plan. The plan is it takes 18 hours to open it. By 18 hours from now, somebody's going to show up. You know, we can get the police here in 18 hours. Okay? But if it was 20 years and the safe locked one day, they couldn't get in for 20 years. No good as a safe. Same with encryption. So the DES is good for very commonly used for transmitting information, the RSA for exchanging keys over an open channel, except, of course, for the man-in-the-middle attacks we've discussed and the other attacks that we discussed earlier. Well, these systems, they keep getting worse. The one-time pad is perfect, except that you have to be able to distribute keys perfectly, which is very hard. Basically, encryption, Shannon's 1949 paper was sort of the major piece of work on encryption and understanding it, and it's worth reading if you get a chance. Overdamped protocols are protocols that tend to reduce the amount of traffic. In other words, they have negative feedback on traffic. So, and it's not hard to design overdamped protocols for all of your network protocols. So maybe we should do that. Temporary blindness. This is an interesting one. In temporary blindness, what we do is we temporarily blind ourselves to something out there because we believe that it's not trustworthy for now. Okay? So, for example, you temporarily ignore network nodes that appear to be misbehaving. You're getting a whole lot of signals from this place. You don't know what they are. You don't believe they should be coming in. You go out to the router, for example, and shut down traffic from there for the next hour. Turn it on later, see if it's better now. If it seems to be right, maybe you'll let it alone. Temporarily disabling accounts for increasing periods of time for every failed password attempt. Okay? They try once, 1 second delay. They try second time, 2 second delay. Try a third time, 4 second delay. A fifth time, 8 second delay. See, it takes the attacker longer and longer and longer to deny more and more services to a potentially legitimate user, making it more and more painful to attack and forcing the attacker to come back again and again and again, making it easier to trace them. Partitioning a network is an emergency procedure in response to an incident. Okay, separating yourself from the internet when some bad thing is happening out on the internet. In a power grid, separating your part of the power grid from the rest of the power grid because there seems to be a cascade failure happening and we don't really want to get ours wiped out too. There hasn't been a lot of detailed analysis of this technique, but there are a lot of cases where it's used. What? It can backfire. It can be exploited by reflexive control. Yes. Fault isolation. When you detect faults, you isolate the components. This is similar to temporary blindness, but slightly different probably. The partitioning of corporate networks from the internet during the Morris worm is an example where they overlap. normally partitioning faulty components from the power grid is commonly done. And again, it's reflexive control. The partitioning of the telephone system into critical and non-critical circuits during a national emergency is another thing that's done. It's not temporary blindness, it's different. They literally have a procedure where they separate critical telephone calls from all you guys. Sorry. And you won't be able to make any phone calls, but the president will be able to call the general and say, don't do it. Hopefully, don't do it. You know what? So if you design it into a system, it's pretty feasible to do it. If it's not previously considered, it takes a lot of effort to retrofit this kind of thing. And of course, you have to test it. Yeah, anybody aware of anybody ever testing the phone systems no longer available? To average user, only available for the government? I'm unaware of any full-scale tests. I think it would be an enlightening experience. I have suggested that they test it. They have suggested that I go back to wherever I came from.
Very old facility. You realize they had not tested for the power backup in a long time. They put the switch, ran it past, the power sort of blew out most of the monitors, more than potentially manual left breakers, but they just said they run out of the cranks while they set the circuit breakers. Nobody died.
Yeah, well, that's good that nobody died. The point is, and we'll get to it later, that you have to test things or else you don't know that they work. Who tests the tester? Well, I don't know. You test it by actually doing it and seeing who dies. out of range detection, like you look for negative values for entries that should be positive and values for future dates, you know, or for historical dates and these sorts of things, and pointers to locations outside the address space. All these things are easy to detect if you have out of range detection. One of the problems is there's a lot of software that enforces various kinds of range checking, but when you turn on Optimize says turn off checking. So you run the program, you write the program, it all works right, then you turn off all the checking to run it in high performance mode, and of course that's when it goes wrong, because you have different code, because you've turned off the checking, and it might not work the same. I've had that too. Reintegration. In the process of prevention, detection, recovery, after you've detected something and you've taken something out and fixed it, then you have to put it all back in. And so you need a process for reintegration to make things work right. So the rebooting of systems that have crashed and in loosely coupled networks is an example, or checkpoints and transaction replay for synchronizing more tightly interconnected systems, and certainly databases and transaction systems work this way. And hardware replacement and resynchronization in redundant computers is fairly common. Tandem, I guess, the tandem computers. You can pull out a board and put in another one and it'll fix itself up. Training and awareness is a good defensive measure. Essentially, you tell people about what to do and they do it. Well, they try. And people have seminars in this and in-house awareness programs and demonstrations where users are shown how they might be vulnerable. And it's a pretty straightforward thing to do. And it provides people with fairly good defense against a large class of attack techniques for a relatively low cost. Yes, training goes beyond what to do when somebody does something malicious to you. That is, you should have people that are trained in what they do. And if you don't, then you're not going to get what you want out of them. But for protection against malicious attacks and even accidents and errors and omissions, training about errors and omissions is something you should do. Say, look, people make mistakes. When you make a mistake, like there's a classic from Australia in the earlier days of viruses, late 80s, I guess. So you had a virus that had infected their backup. And so what they did was they went to the other, and it had destroyed all the information on their floppies, on their backups. So without turning the computer off or rebooting from a fresh disk, they went and got their only backups on their floppy disks, which were, of course, not write protected, and stuck one after another in to try and restore the system, wiping out their backups. So, you know, clearly, we need to train people how to do things well. And it's relatively inexpensive, and it works very well against a broad spectrum of things. Organizations provide specifications of what's expected and how it's all governed. That's policy. For example, a clear usage policy with details of how it's enforced and what happens when you break the rules. Now, I want to point out the high level of effectiveness of policies. At one organization that I'm aware of, they had a policy against bringing in pornographic information. I don't know something about, except for if you're high enough in the organization, of course you can, but I'm not lying to you. But so they warned employees that you're going to be fired if you do this. And then an employee brought the information in. So the boss came to this employee and said, look, here's the policy. You broke the policy. I should, by all rights, I should fire you. If you do this again, I'm going to fire you, period. Don't do this. I'm going to fire you. I did it anyway. Got fired. Next guy does the same thing. The boss says, if you do it again, I'm going to fire you. And I fired the last guy. And he did it again. And got fired. It's beyond my comprehension, right? If you don't want the job, why don't you just quit? Was there some benefit in being fired? That goes on your record as a good thing? I guess it's that unemployment check. So policies are good things to have, like policies against illegal copies of software help to reduce your liability from lawsuits, etc. You say, look, we told them not to do it. We had a policy against it. We tried to enforce it. So we're only going to have to pay this much. Still lose, but lose by less. Another one is a clear specification of who's responsible for what functions, because a lot of policies sort of don't actually designate who's responsible, so there are food fights and other such things. Here's a good technique, rerouting of attacks. But, you know, I have to wonder, I know what that is. Sometimes I put up a graphic and I don't know what it means. Rerouting attacks, you shunt things away from the most critical systems. For example, honeypots that I mentioned before are used to lure attackers away from real targets, as well as to gather information about them. Lightning rods are another variation on the theme. In a lightning rod, you take people from places you know are not authorized, and you ground them somewhere. That you attach them to some other system. They go to what they think is System A, and it's actually System B, but it looks like System A to them. And they're happy. They go attack it. They do whatever they're going to do, and you don't care because it's like the lightning. It's shunted to the ground. Your building is safe. Like that. And then we have jails. Jails used to encapsulate attackers and watch their behavior. And that's what this is supposed to be. These are the bars in the front of the jail. So, not a very good jail. But standards are a good protective mechanism. You use widely known methods to implement protection in the hope that they've been well studied, and there's a community investment in their proper operation. For example, the X509 certificates for interoperable key management is a fairly effective. It has problems, but at least it's standard. When something goes wrong with it, if it's really bad, everybody will know that went wrong with it, and people will rush to try and fix it. And there'll be a groundswell. If you have Joe's crypto system, and you know Joe tripped last night and hurt his knee, he's not going to come fix it because somebody broke into your system today. But if X509 stops working properly, there's going to be some attention paid. The Orange Book standard, here's a case where you have a higher assurance that the system is going to meet certain requirements because it meets the standard. And ISO 9000 processes for high quality industrial grade quality assurance. Standards tend to reduce complexity of meeting assurance requirements. And they do it in a couple of ways. One of them is because you're sharing work, so you're getting an economy of scale. And another one is they give you better interoperability. So that's a valuable aid in eliminating these vulnerabilities. procedures. Similarly, you use specific methods to implement protection and hope that by uniformity, they'll be effective. For example, you use checklists to verify proper status during pre-flight. Okay? Well, you can do the same thing with computer systems. Every time you install a such and such a system, you go through your pre-flight checklist. You make sure that these accounts are disabled, and this is enabled, and this is turned off, and these are turned on, and like that. You can regularly performing backups. That's a standard procedure to assure that information isn't inadvertently lost. And a well-defined process for dealing with bomb threats made over the telephone. Right? If you don't have a standard bomb threat process, you should have one. You have a card at the desk that says, here's what you do when somebody calls you with a bomb threat. You know, try and get specific information. And I'm sure that there are plenty of people that will hand you good checklists. Developing and implementing standards is not difficult. It can be greatly aided by standard notebooks and checklists and other similar aids. And people like that. People, you know, my kids like to have crayons on pieces of paper and fill out forms and stuff because it's fun. Same thing. People like to go down checklists. Now, they might always just check off that they did the right thing and not do it. So then you need a checker to check the checkers. That's called auditing. Boy, amazing how that works, isn't it? When I'm talking about auditing, I'm talking about human auditors, human beings, possibly with the aid of tools to review organizations or systems for compliance with laws and regulations, for control, or in other areas of interest, the management. There are lots of different kinds of audits. For example, internal auditors, there are external auditors, there are EDP auditors that specialize in particular kinds of systems. Usually these are electronic data processing systems that process financial transactions. There are financial auditors that look at the books. There are so-called IT auditors that's sort of a new breed, and I've heard other names for them, new breed of auditors that look at the value of information and information capabilities in your organization as value rather than looking at dollars in financial statements as value, and they're different, it turns out. Auditing, of course, requires expertise in the particulars of the system undergoing inspection and the area in which compliance is being evaluated. So you might have a copyright audit of your PCs or something like that. You need somebody who's competent in understanding the copyright issues as well as understanding PCs. There's another related area called audit trail analysis where events of potential security relevance are recorded and then analyzed to detect and track down illicit activities. For example, this is for generation recording. You might have audit records made by financial systems and used to identify fraudulent use, or sign-in sheets to find out who has entered or left an area and at what time, or computer-generated audit records to track logins, program executions, file accesses, etc. And then examples on the analytical side are searching for indicators of known attacks that appear in audit records. This is intrusion detection systems can do this sometimes. There's also tools called audit reduction tools that take a whole bunch of audit trails and turn it into only the ones that are of any value to you, hopefully. So there's no theory about how good that is. Sorting and thresholding of audit trails to detect patterns of misuse, and the cross-correlation of audit records to detect inconsistencies. There's an interesting case where there was a student who was being accused of breaking into computer systems, and the audit trails that they showed did not support that student had actually done that, and the administrator at the university said, well, he could have modified the audit trails. And they said, is there any evidence, the group evaluating it said, is there any evidence that these things have been modified? And the person could not show any evidence that they had been modified, and therefore the person was let off. And then the question came to me of, could you actually show evidence of modification if it existed? And so what I did was I started to analyze, and I looked at, for example, you have a web server and system audit trails. And if you look for a given audit trail on the web server, there might be a corresponding audit trail in the system that says somebody came in over the internet, and here's an audit trail that says here's their web request. Well, by cross-correlating those different audit trails, you can find out things where people came into the system but there was no web request associated with it, and vice versa. And if you're careful about it, you can find inconsistencies if somebody tried to forge audit trails. So looking for consistencies might even be more informative. It can be very complex. There are several NP-complete audit analysis problems that have been identified. Misuse detection. There are a variety of different ways that you can examine information to detect things. Misuse For example, audit-based misuse detection, we're looking for specific sequences indicative of known attacks, like a virus scanner. Okay? Analysis of system state to detect misset values or unauthorized changes. So you look through the whole protection state of the machine and try and find settings that aren't right, or changes since last time that don't seem to be right or that shouldn't have been authorized, that you didn't make that were yours. Network-based observation of terminal sessions and analyzing them to detect known attack sequences, another example. In general, this is an undecidable because it potentially involves, for example, detecting all viruses, which is also known to be undecidable. It's a very difficult area. Yes, sir?
Are there tools available that go beyond just detection and react and respond?
We will talk about response hopefully somewhere. There are some tools. Well, a lot of the tools provide some response capability. That is, when they detect something, they allow you the flexibility to page yourself, to make a phone call, to send email, to disable the router, to blow up the machine room, to kill the hostages, whatever. The problem is that it's very easy to fool this guy into killing the hostages, in which case, you've lost your position because and your moral imperative is downhill. I'm sure there are plenty of vendors here that would love to chat with you about that, by the way. There's an NITV study, National Infrastructure Technical Baseline Study on Intrusion Detection and Response, and you can get to it on my web server or on the DOE web server, and I'll put up the information near the end of the class on this, and that will detail the current state of the art in intrusion detection and response for your enjoyment. At great length, yeah. Anomaly detection is, instead of detecting known patterns of abuse, you're detecting behavior that is different from normal behavior, changes in behavior that are unexpected. So, for example, detect excessive use at unusual hours, changes in system calls made by the user processes, these sorts of things. And there's a lot of work that's been done on this, and generally it involves a trade-off between false positives and false negatives. More of one means fewer of the other. There's an old saying, the best deterrent is swift and certain capture and punishment. I believe that. In fact, I firmly believe that if we could just go out and arrest, I bet there aren't more than a few thousand people really out there attacking systems on a regular basis. And if we could just, capture them all and throw them in jail, we would only have the serious attackers, but we don't know how to detect it. Yes, but we know what to look for. Obviously, it's not an easy matter to catch all these people. Improved morality. Hey, no kidding. People are brought into a level of moral agreement and awareness that prevents them from doing the wrong thing. Situation ethics classes are actually a valuable thing to promoting this. Improved morality training and these sorts of things. And, changing the hearts and minds of people is clearly not something they just do offhand. On the other hand, there are a variety of things that show that people who are happy in their work, people that have good relations with the people around them in their work, are less likely than disgruntled employees about to be fired to attack your information system. So there's something to be said for improving morality and morale, actually. Awareness of the implications, okay? One of the things I really like about working where I work is that we get periodic updates on what will happen to us if we ever do anything bad. They don't say it that way. They say it's an awareness briefing, and they tell us about who's been arrested lately and how they're going to be spending the rest of their life in prison, how this guy committed suicide, and that guy was found with a bag over his head, but we don't know quite how he got that kind of a bag in his cell, and that kind of stuff. But I think that's actually very useful. Briefings on people that have been caught and punished is really neat, because a lot of people say, yeah, but I can't get caught. Well, this says, oh yeah, you can. We caught one, and by the way, he's dead now. He was 37 years old, he had a wife, he's dead, and his children are dead. And you can do it too. Here's the key. We'll be watching. details of what happened to innocent victims. as a result, is also very useful because of the moral issues. And personal appearances by people who have been involved in various phases of the process are always useful. It's not, nothing really compares to having the FBI agent in to discuss how he tracked this guy down. You know, and how he caught him with his girlfriend. You know, and how his wife was embarrassed when he had to come down to court and identify him with his girlfriend. So it's easily accomplished, and it's proven a strong deterrent. Periodic reassessment is a basic principle. You know, the world's changing. Protection has to change, too. If you don't periodically reassess how you have protection set, then you're not keeping up. In fact, there's a really well-known consultant whose name will remain unnamed today here, who says, he's very interesting, he says, if you called me here, you cannot possibly have good protection. Because if you have good protection, you know you have good protection. And if you don't know if you have good protection, you don't. And you couldn't get it by accident. And if you happen to have it by accident today, you know, through an act of God for 1 second, by tomorrow morning it would be lousy. Because everything else is still changing. Your protection has to be changing with it, or it's not going to be effective. You need to periodically review it. Annual outside audits are very helpful. Regular testing is very important for that. So it's easily done, and of course the quality of the results depends on the quality of the people doing it. There is the often touted principle of least privilege. An individual is only granted enough privilege to accomplish the assigned task, but no more. For example, it would be nice if you could put limitations on control over infrastructure. Unfortunately, in most organizations that have substantial information infrastructures, they don't have limitations. That is, whoever's authorized to fix the routers can fix all the routers everywhere. All 10 of the people that are authorized to do that are authorized to fix them all. I know of at least one very large financial institution that has, oh, probably 50,000, I kid you not, computers distributed throughout the world, and one root password. 5,000 administrators, and each of those 5,000 administrators has root access on all 50,000 of those computers. Okay? That is not least privilege. User file backup and restore without unlimited system access is another example of it. And read-only access by auditors. You know, I go into audit places all the time, and I just flat refuse to touch the keyboard. I do. I say, show me this, show me that. Because I just don't want to be the person that touched the keyboard when their infrastructure went down. Because I know they'll blame it on me. And the idea that you should be able to modify something when you're an auditor is nuts. There's no basis for it. Financial situation checking. You check the records of individuals to detect unusual patterns indicative of bribes, extortion, and other impropriety. For example, periodic examination of bank records, observation to detect excessive or inadequate lifestyle, and credit checks. There are these privacy and cost issues, unfortunately. Or is it fortunately? One thing is, it's awful tough to get somebody's permission, if they're stealing from you, to check their financial condition all the time. And without their permission, it's real hard to do it. There's another problem is that it's pretty darn expensive to do that. And so they don't. And that's why, until they suspect that somebody came into the Central Intelligence Agency as a director and started leaking secrets, they couldn't check his finances. Even though he was coming to work in a Porsche or whatever, you know, Mercedes, Lamborghini. You know. But he's only $30,000 a year. we save every month, $3 a month, and we got the Lamborghini in just under 5 years.
Good investment.
Yes. Good investment, yes. Hillary Clinton. I invest with Hillary Clinton, you see, in this. I'm bullish on America. Or that's good hiring practices. You use a hiring process to that verifies that people are likely to be loyal, upstanding, honest, and trustworthy. For example, the background checks we talked about before, reference checks. It's amazing what small portion of people actually call up all the references when somebody gives them references. It turns out there's a fair percentage of people, if you call the references, they either never heard of him or they think he was a lousy employee. You never checked. You don't find out. Competency tests. They're actually, you know, they're some of the bigger companies. HP used to do this all the time. They'd bring you in when you went to work for HP, and they would test you for like 4 days. They would give you the hardest engineering test you've ever seen, worse than your worst final exams at any university. And then they knew. They said, either you can do this or not. If you can do it, and you're going to work on our super silicon, you know, whatever factory, and if you can't, then, you know, $20,000 a year, you can work as a secretary, but we're not interested. The other one is, there's a commonly used personality trait analysis. There are a couple of these. Now, I don't want to say that these are particularly great at doing what they do, but a lot of people swear by them. And there's a lot of work that's been done on psychological factors and profiling of people. Separation of duties. Now, I talked about the least privilege. It's closely related to separation of duties. But in this case, it's not the privileges, but the duties of the person. For example, limiting need-to-know areas for individuals, eliminating single administrative points of failure, and limiting administrative domains. A classic example of separation of duties is related to who can write purchase orders and who can pay on the purchase orders. But I've put that under separation of function instead, don't ask me why. The use of separate and different media, for example, for backups. Right? If you do a backup using the same media as the original, and there's some sort of a failure that's media dependent, then the backup's going to get hit just like the original. So it has to be separate and different. The division of interlinking functions over need-to-know areas and separation of purchasing from accounts payable, I consider functional separation. In practice, especially in small corporations, efficiency takes precedence over effectiveness in this separation process. Multi-person controls, you know what business I'm in. More than one person is required in order to turn that switch. You can't turn that switch on your own. If you turn it before me, you're going to die. And if I turn it before you, I'm going to die. And if we don't turn it at the same time, it's not going to go boom. Cryptographic key distribution systems in which keys are shared among many individuals. Okay, it requires 5 of the 7 people that have the keys to cooperate before we'll let you do this, for example. M of N systems. Voting systems in which majority must agree or some portion must agree before some action is taken. Some of them are very complex, but there's no fundamental complexity with these sorts of systems that prohibits its use when it's warranted. If you have something that would call for this, it's not expensive, it's not difficult, and it works real well. Multi-version programming. Believe it or not, some people actually use multiple versions of programs. They really do. Multi-version, the space shuttle uses multi-version programming. There's more than one version of the same program that does the guidance when it's coming through its hypersonic S-curve. And the reason is that after enough of these processors fail, they need to have something to get them in because it's dynamically unstable. If they fail to control for a millisecond or so, then the thing goes tumbling and then goes away. So what they have is, besides having redundant hardware, they have redundant software. So that if one of the algorithms has some sort of a problem with the algorithm, it switches to an alternative algorithm. Now, of course, if the alternative algorithm doesn't work, well, the original didn't work either, so nothing lost, right? No, but that would have been lost otherwise.